Right. So if Graham's ready and I'm ready and Mike looks poised like the big jungle cat, Ben is always ready, it must be time for the Linux Voice Podcast Series 3, Episode 18. I'm Andrew Gregory. I was wrong, Ben isn't ready. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in this, I hate to blow my own trumpet, but it's awesome. In this awesome episode of the Linux Voice podcast, we've got news, we've got something else, we've got a halfway reminder, we don't have any Finds of the Fortnight, and we don't have any neurons to vocalise. Oh, sorry, we do have Finds of the Fortnight. There we go. And we've got a great voice of the masses. I'm not ready either. I'm going to take another sip of tea. If you like the sound of this podcast, but slightly better organised, you can get a paper version. But I say paper version, it's a magazine. And it's called Linux Voice, and it's all about Linux and free software. If you don't like paper, you can get it on an electronic version. You can subscribe, you can buy us in Asda and Sainsbury's and Tesco's and WH Smith's and Barnes & Noble and all around the world, all good news agents, not the bad ones.
In fact, it's a good way of finding out which ones are the bad ones and which ones are the good ones.
like a desire path.
Yeah, yeah.
Make Doesn't issue 21 go on sale today?
I think it does, Mike. Well done.
I am
well
prepared.
Done, Mike. Well done, Mike. Super wet.
It's the Braveheart issue.
Yeah, and for those who aren't listening to this live, what day is today?
Thursday, the 22nd, the day after Back to the Future Day.
You know, I was born in 1980, so the year after the first Alien film, 4 years before Terminator, 7 years before RoboCop. I've never been promised jetpacks and hoverboards. I've been promised a hellish dystopian future controlled by faceless corporations using technology to exert power over the common man. And it's all come true.
You're not disappointed at all, then.
I did read something interesting that everybody's complaining about the lack of hoverboards from their always connected handheld devices with all the sum of humankind contained therein.
Good point.
Okay, first off in our news this fortnight, LibreOffice has been rebranded GovOffice and is now available in the UK government's internal tech marketplace. This is a move by Collabora to try and integrate themselves more into the British government. And although it's not a fixed rollout, there's no sort of set departments that are suddenly going to switch to GovOffice. It's sort of the first step in becoming available, and now it sort of eliminates all the barriers to tech teams or any teams within the UK public sector implementing LibreOffice. So we look forward to more news in the future from this.
Yeah, and I saw that this GovOffice spin-off has LTS support, so long-term support over many years. I'm not sure how long, but this is 5 years. Yeah, this sort of stuff is critical for governments, and they don't want to just keep updating to the latest version, which can bring in bugs or changes. They just want the same code base being fixed for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. But it has some other new features rolled in as well, doesn't it, as I understand it?
When you say they want the long support, I mean, these are the same government departments that are still paying for XP support.
Yeah.
They don't change stuff in a hurry.
It's fantastic news. It's a great endorsement as well. You know, not outside of the UK government. It's the kind of thing that other people will look at and say, oh, well, if it's being used by the UK government or can potentially be, then it's probably good enough for me. Or at least I'll give it a try.
I think the rebranding is probably a good move as well. I think it's something you can do with open source software. It's often not pushed enough that you can sort of just little tweaks just to make it fit in a bit better. Even if it's just sort of makes it sound better to managers who don't really know what's going on. It's GovOffice. It must be special for us.
Yeah, doesn't it feature our monarch's crown?
Looking Hello. Cool.
Yeah. Welcome to my office suite. No ribbon here.
No, I can see that's going to be as annoying as robot voice. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it is. And more good open source or Linuxy news at least, are the first official Steam machines have been sent out to review. And they'll be available on sale from the 10th of November. We're not deemed important enough to be invited to review such things, so we can only relay what we've heard from others. And from what I've seen, all the reviews have been fairly positive. I haven't heard anyone be too critical of it. The sort of the interface has been redesigned a little bit recently to make it easier to use through the controller from your living room. And the number of games is just ridiculous now. It's over 1,500.
Yeah.
So is a Steam machine basically a PC with a set specification running SteamOS?
Well, bear in mind that all consoles now are basically just PCs. The different thing about Steambox is it's not really a set specification. You can put whatever you want in there, which means there's a massive difference in price. I think the low-end ones come out about £290, and you can pay like thousands, like quite a few thousands if you want the ones with just stupid hardware in them.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much up to what you put in it, but obviously that will limit the games you can play, the resolutions, etc., the quality of the graphics.
Just like a normal PC.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it's got SteamOS, which has what they call the big picture interface, which means, you know, it's not like a regular desktop. It's designed to be used from the console, sat on your couch. So there's no sort of fiddling about with a mouse and keyboard trying to get everything set up. You just go in, use it, and it's all easy from the off. It's a console experience, basically.
I do have, we haven't got those machines, but I do have a Steam box underneath my TV, which I use and keep updated for playing games off my Steam library. And I really like what Valve's done with the interface. I think the experience for people who are buying like a Steam box off the shelf is going to be just the same as if they'd bought a PlayStation 4 or an Xbox. More like PlayStation 4, because the user interface is much more like the PlayStation's interface, you know, left and right between modes and down to game libraries. But the interesting thing is the Steam. So those Steam boxes are just PCs, but the Steam Link is like a small, like a Chrome plug or one of the Amazon Fire boxes. The Steam Link is like a low cost streaming client. It's like £80, and it you can get it bundled with one of the new Steam controllers, which is one of the other major updates. And this will stream games from a PC somewhere else in the house, which I think is really interesting, because it means you can still have a really ugly, powerful PC somewhere in the house, which are much cheaper to build. I mean, even the most expensive Steam boxes seem to have mobile GPUs, and then stream high-quality games to your television down in the living room. And I just read that it's been rooted, and you know, there's even the potential, I suppose, that we could get generic ARM boards with the same GPU on and turn them into really cheap Steam Link boxes for playing games on, which I think is pretty cool.
One thing I was wondering when I was thinking about this morning is, as I said earlier, Xboxes, PS4s, etc., are all basically just PCs. There's no real difference to them. So the only thing stopping you turning an Xbox into a Steam machine is the sort of the software block. So if you could root an Xbox, you could probably build or convert it into a Steam machine. What the performance would be like, I don't know.
Yeah, you're right. I think probably the price performance would be pretty good, because the prices of those things are offset by Sony and Microsoft over the 7 years that you're going to own it and all the titles that you're going to buy for it.
Yeah.
Especially at the moment. But I think I haven't looked into it, but I think the PS4 and the Xbox are a long way off being rootable. And you should be, I mean, at least in the old days, Sony used to make a console that you could kind of install Linux on and do your own stuff with, even if you couldn't access the full power of the console. But then just don't buy a PlayStation. Just get a PC, turn it into a Steam box. This is a bit snarky, but I read the Ars Technica review of the Steam box and picked up slightly on the fact that they launched the X11 windowing system called Xterm and were disappointed to find a simple console prompt. So and everybody reviewing this has mentioned Linux, you know, so in all of the mainstream press, the BBC, the Guardian, Ars Technica, you know, they always mention that this is Linux, which you never find when they're reviewing Android devices. So at least that is something that's kind of come through.
Yeah, and it's always been Linux in like a really positive light as well. It's not been like, oh, here's Linux is some weird geeky thing that you probably never need to deal with. It's been like, here's a really cool thing using Linux that you can go out and, or next week you'll be able to go out and get.
Yeah, and you can turn it on and start playing games in 5 minutes and never see Xterm. You
know. Just don't try and launch the graphical user interface.
Yeah. I think it's a great thing. I think it's a brilliant thing. It's great that they've come to fruition and that we're seeing the boxes, and I hope it means that more games are going to come to Linux in the future.
Yeah, it's bound to mean more games coming. Right, moving on to slightly sadder news, I think. JPEG, the Joint Photographic Experts Group, are currently in a meeting holed up in Brussels to decide whether or not to add DRM, digital rights management, to the JPEG file format. This already exists in one version of the JPEG format, JPEG 2000, but that's not sort of the widely used thing that we all know as JPEG, so that's sort of a bit more of a specialist type thing. This is about putting it in the mainstream version of JPEG. And obviously this has drawn criticism from people like the EFF who have given a presentation to the group to say, well, don't do this, this is obviously stupid.
I just don't get how DRM can work for anything you consume passively, like audio or pictures. What's going to stop you pressing the print screen button to copy a JPEG?
There's no reason that you can't disable the print screen button at a kernel level when the JPEG's displayed. In fact, there's actually some specific hardware in Intel CPUs to enable you to do that at a lower level than at the OS. There's actually something that can disable access to the frame buffer.
Sheesh, yeah. Well, I can see that happening in maybe Windows and OS 10.
But... And that's what happens in Android devices now, effectively, you know, when you're looking at Netflix being played. It's awful. It's terrible. And I'm imagining it's... Is it mostly for the web? Is it so that they can lock down the web?
Well, there's a couple of things I didn't get about this. Because, okay, you can create this JPEG file and you can add DRM to it. As far as I can tell, there'll be nothing to stop you taking that file and putting it unmodified in a different website.
Maybe it's
tied to a domain.
It's encrypted, tied to a cookie running in your browser session or something.
It's possible. I suspect it's going to be more to do with editing it and that sort of thing. So,
right.
I mean, this is
right.
Like, it's actually already exists in quite a few places. If you try and photocopy most banknotes, you'll just get a blank piece of paper, and it'll be the same if you open a picture of them up in most image editing software. They've got some crazy jazz. You'll see on most banknotes have a series of yellow dots on them. And the particular constellation of these yellow dots is recognized by printers and photocopiers and image editing software to stop you trying to pass off a black and white photocopy as a tenner. Apparently, this is likely.
Isn't that called like the Euro constellation or something?
Yeah, Orion, I think.
Oh, that's it.
Which actually, I was writing a piece for another magazine once on currency, and because we weren't using a particularly good image library, you just couldn't get any pictures of currency. But yeah, so it'll be a similar sort of thing that you won't be able to modify or edit these JPEG images. Which, I don't know, even if they wanted it, it's hard to see it actually happening, because if you put one of these digitally protected images on your site, no one with a browser made earlier than today will be able to view it. So if you open it up in your current Firefox, you'll get no images. If you open it up in Internet Explorer as it is now, it won't be able to view it. Yeah. If you open it up on your iPhone, you won't be able to view it. And all you're going to get is a load of angry people saying, I can't view any of these images.
Yeah, but they'll have a fallback mode for 10 years, and then in 10 years' time, they'll switch it on, and everyone will be like, oh.
Yeah.
Why can't I, you know, show you my picture? Why can't I copy my photos off my camera phone to another device without paying you some money?
Yeah. Why can't I post a picture of a happy child with some text written over it on Reddit?
It's awful. The DRM, bad. DRM and JPEG images when they've been around for so long. Crazy idea. Who thinks it's the right thing to do? And what's the problem that it's solving?
Yeah. I remember when we were talking to Corey Doctorow about DRM and allowing things in Firefox, allowing things like Netflix to play. And he said the thing you got to realise is that there's a lot of content publishers who want to put DRM on everything in their website. They want it on the text. They want it on the images. So if you allow this one chink in, you'll suddenly find that your entire web session is DRM. You won't be able to copy and paste from it. You won't be able to do anything like that. So maybe this is just another step down that road. Maybe it won't stop at images. Maybe it will go.
Just a side note about DRM. If you really dislike DRM and want a refuge from it, you could do worse than subscribe to Linux Voice, because our EPUBs and PDFs are completely DRM free.
Although all our images in the EPUB are JPEG, so we could start adding DRM to that. Okay, and continuing our slide down the slope from happy news to sad news, we hit rock bottom in our final item of news this fortnight. The NSA has probably broken Diffie-Hellman key exchange. As with all such news relating to the NSA, you should take this with a heavy pinch of salt. Nothing's confirmed. Nothing's ever going to be confirmed.
So what is Diffie-Hellman key exchange? And who is the NSA?
Well, the NSA is the National Security Agency in America who have two roles, one of which is to break all communication and the other is to secure all communication. And as you may realise, there is some conflict between these two roles. So they have bad sides where they do stuff like they break Diffie-Hellman key exchange, and they have good sides where they create things like SE Linux, which protects us from hackers. But this is their bad side operating. And Diffie-Hellman key exchange is genuinely my favourite algorithm in the whole of computing, because it does something that doesn't seem like it's possible. It allows you to share a password on an open network with no one else being able to discover it. So there's four of us here on this video chat, and it would allow me and Andrew to exchange a password without Mike or Graham being able to work out what that password is, and we could do that without using any encryption at all.
What, just body language?
No, just our words. It relies on some pretty weird maths, so I won't delve into it too deep, but the basic idea is that you've got this function, we'll call this an encryption function, that takes two inputs, and in total we're going to use three different numbers. We'll call them A, B and C, and the property of this function is such that if you combine A with B and then the result of that with C, you get the same result as if you combine A with C and then the result of that with B. So you can swap the orders of the numbers round, they get into this encryption function. And we start off, me and Andrew, by deciding on the first number, and we can do this in public. So me and Andrew just pick a number. So I'll shout to Andrew, the number's three. So you now all know that the first number is three. So what we do now is I pick a second number and Andrew picks a third number, but we don't tell anyone what they are. I put this number through the little encryption function, so I get the result of A, which was three, and my secret number. Andrew does it the same thing with him and his secret number. And then we shout the results of these together. Well, across to each other, which obviously we can't do because we don't know what the function is. But then we combine what we've just told each other with our own secret number, and we'll both end up with the same password, but neither you or Mike will have been able to work it out. It's quite a complicated algorithm, I'll grant you. It's hard to explain. That's the best I can do.
So why do they think the NSA has cracked this?
Well, there's been a few sort of hints at it, really. When you're looking at the sort of documents like the stuff Snowden's released, there's no details of it, but there's sort of lines on diagrams about what information's going where that's allowing them to do it. And it sort of points to this. And what they believe they've done is they've designed a supercomputer, probably built out of specialist chips designed just to do this job. such that when the first number that we decided on, in our previous case it was 3, what they've done is they've taken, for that number, they've worked out every possible combination of numbers and the results. So that when we say our sort of encrypted, the first one that we sent to each other, they could just look it up in a table and work out what our secret numbers were. And they sort of added up some sums and did the maths on this, and they reckoned that for a single first number, that would cost a few $100 million and take about a year. Some security researchers, I'd say, wrote this out. And which shouldn't be a problem, because obviously that first number can be any large prime. But because a lot of people thought it wasn't likely to be broken, they just hard-coded in a large prime. So there's one large prime that's used by 80% of all Diffie-Hellman.
Right. No, it's clear, yeah.
Failed. So that's the fix, is it?
Well, there's a few potential fixes. One is, yeah, to just start using a different large prime. One is to use a more secure version, so rather than 124-bit, which is the version that's believed to be broken, move up to 248 or whatever. Another is to use another protocol, for example, the elliptic curve version of Diffie-Hellman, which isn't vulnerable or isn't thought to be vulnerable to this attack. So there's quite a few potential solutions there. But anything you've sent over SSH or over a VPN in the last sort of few years could well all belong to the NSA now.
Oh, no. Still, I've done nothing wrong. I've nothing to fear.
You've got nothing to hide. No.
I don't understand.
I just use Telnet, so I'm fine.
With ROT 13, yeah.
I use a password so they can't get me, right?
It does. I think, you know, all encryption will be cracked in the end. Sorry, Andrew.
I don't think Andrew was saying anything. He's just despairing.
I'm looking sad underneath my beers.
Let's go back to
sad face on.
Meeting in pubs and discussing things over a pint of beer.
We can do that this Christmas, I reckon.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Oh, we can do it sooner then, or at least Ben Graham and I can.
Oh, yes, we can.
In Liverpool at the end of the month.
Hooray! Oddcamp, apparently, although if you look at the Oddcamp website, you'd never guess.
And that's the news this fortnight.
Excellent. Thanks for the... I think you should have finished on the happy story, though, because I now really have very little motivation to carry on. It's now time for Finds of the Fortnight, my favourite section in the podcast. It used to be Discoveries of the Week, that used to be my favourite, but now it's definitely Finds of the Fortnight. I must admit, I haven't found that. I've been really busy, but I haven't found that much interesting, cool new stuff. I installed CyanogenMod 12.2 on my phone, and I really like it. I haven't personally vetted the source code, so I really don't know if it's any more open or anything than Google's default binaries, but I think it's a lovely, yeah. It's 5.1. So this is 12.1, CyanogenMod 12.1. So it's got all the nice eye candy, all the nice battery-saving stuff, features that I didn't even notice in the vanilla 5.1. So I don't know if they're additions from CyanogenMod or not. But really, I haven't installed the Google apps to go alongside it. I use F-Droid to get stuff. And basically, I keep my phone... Not for any particular reason. It just gets out of hand when I install a million apps and it becomes far too much of a distraction. So CyanogenMod, it's great. I mean, good work on Google. Great that it's open source. Great that something like CyanogenMod or Replicant can exist. Anybody else? Oh, there are some finds from IRC. Maybe I'll do that next.
Oh, good.
I asked just before we started recording on the pod, just before those few seconds of silence, whether anyone on IRC wanted to share something. P. Waring notably points out that Let's Encrypt, the fantastic initiative to create and give free automated certificates for your own use, has become trusted by a dent trust. So the certificates that are now going to be issued through Let's Encrypt will be trusted via our browsers, which means that you won't have to go through any of those warnings or anything. I still don't think you can apply to get your own certificates yet, but I think it's going to happen soon in the next month or two. That is great news, because before now you had to jump through a load of hoops, or if you wanted a free certificate, go through, you know, not usually the best service or support. And it's great. Although, bearing in mind what you've just said about encryption, Ben, you know, still. it basically means you can create encrypted connections to your own websites and to your own services that are going to be trusted by other people in the same way that Amazon's shopping cart is trusted when you check out.
So technically, the difference between that and the Diffie-Hellman bit is that the certificates allow you to verify that it's the right computer you're communicating with. The Diffie-Hellman key exchange is then used afterwards to create a secure connection to that computer. Yeah.
Enom points out that Red Hat has acquired Ansible, which was big news last week. Maybe we should have had it in the news section. Ansible, I think, is like a network deployment configuration tool.
Configuration management, isn't yeah. it? It's a sort of DevOpsy thing that we don't tend to cover that much. But
yeah. I suppose it's big news for Red Hat. Probably more to do with its cloud policies or strategies, you know, in terms of deploying cloud instances and then managing them through a single interface. We've got Arthur D. My find is that Simple Screen Recorder is great for capturing game output. Simple Screen Recorder is indeed a fantastic application. We've not done any videos on our YouTube channel for too long, I admit, but when we did, we used Simple Screen Recorder because it works so well. It's brilliant, and the fact that it can capture game output is another great advantage.
There's also is it Simple Screen Recorder GTK, for those of you who don't like the command line?
Oh, right, yeah.
Big red recorder. I used bang.
The video that I did on capturing the Bitwig Studio running through Jack was just cool. So the audio was literally running through this audio application that went back to Simple Screen Recorder. So all the effects that I was doing happened in real time. Devilman points out that he mentioned a find last week. It's Shell in a Box, a web-based SSH terminal to access remote service. He points to a link where it is indeed just a shell in a web interface. I assume that you can, you know, host your own, but that's a very good that's a very interesting find. I think that's most it. There's a couple more, but I haven't I wouldn't be able to summarize them effectively, so take a look at our IRC channel if you want to find more finds. That's from the IRC.
I've got one that I've actually discovered myself this time. So we're making progress, and it's W3M, the text mode web browser. I've used a few other text mode browsers before, like Lynx, the L-I-N-K-S one, as opposed to the really old one with Y. But W3M is the best one I found in terms of formatting websites. And I sort of discovered it because I was at Munich Airport recently, and I had a 2-hour extra delay, and I tried to use the Wi-Fi, and it was ridiculously slow. I could connect, but we were talking about 1 kilobyte a second. So I logged in, I SSH'd in to a Raspberry Pi I've got running at home, and I ran W3M on it, so I could browse Reddit, read discussions, read Wikipedia, and of course it was very fast, because the only information being sent to me was the screen update. I wasn't even downloading these sites. So I'm sitting there, all these other people around me are annoyed at the delay, and they're trying to connect using Windows 10 and OS 10, which of course are trying to download huge amounts of updates in the background. They're like slamming their laptop shut and all shouting at each other. They cannot do anything.
Get a beer and buy a newspaper.
Doesn't seem to work. They were all raged because of their rubbish proprietary software, and I'm there chatting Reddit, Wikipedia, having the greatest time with a beer as well, of course.
Look so how far we've come in the 30 years from Back to the Future. Yeah.
Yeah, I just couldn't imagine trying to do something like that, especially on Windows 10 with its telemetry. It's always doing stuff over the network, whereas all I was doing was downloading screen request updates for a terminal. It was great.
That is a good find, though, Mike. There have been several real times when I've needed a browser on the command line. I have got no access to anything else, and Lynx is just a little bit too primitive in terms of JavaScript and other stuff that I just can't get what I need.
Yeah, I'm not sure if W3M has JavaScript, but I managed to log into the HTML version of Google Mail and actually check my emails as well. The layout was actually fairly good. With Lynx, it tends to just put everything from top to bottom, even different divs and tables. It just goes in a big long list and makes it horrible. But W3M actually recreated the layout pretty well, enough to make it usable.
Excellent, excellent. Great find. Anyone else want to have a go?
Yes, please.
Go for it, Andrew.
So yet again, the kind folks of the internet furnish me with finds.
They love you.
They know that. They know that I'm so rubbish and I just need help. So Brendan in New Zealand says, here's a find. Turn your Android phone into a dictaphone. Great for recording meeting notes or who said the most nonsense at the pub the other night. It's FOSS and in the F-Droid repositories. And that's dictophone, like with a D-I-K-T-O-F-O-N. So that's, yeah. Appropriately enough, obviously, what with the time zones and everything, New Zealand is in the future.
And again, and a couple more. Also from Brendan. Cheers, Brendan. Thanks ever so much, really. FontForge. I know that Mike wrote a tutorial about FontForge, did you?
Well, it was Bird Font I wrote Bird Font back in the day.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one of the awesome things about FontForge is its documentation. It's an awesome program for designing typefaces, and it also has amazingly inspirational documentation that will get people up and running on the theory on typeface design. So rather than just, you know, here's your line tools, here's your Bezier curves, off you go, and creating gibberish. As you know, theory on typeface design, it's on GitHub, and there's loads and loads of documentation. And the third find, also from Brendan, cheers Brendan, is a project called Lumio, which is a decision making software for large groups of people. You know, normally the person that shouts loudest gets heard. But this is like it's like a collaboration tool thing, but I don't know.
Sounds like a Harry Potter.
It's hard to explain. Yeah, Accio decision.
Just trying to bring in a younger audience, that's all.
It sounds like a One Direction song. And there's a couple of YouTube videos to describe what that colour is, and it's headquartered in Wellington, New Zealand. And those are my / Brendan's finds.
Shall I go next?
That would be perfection. Perfection personified.
Well, I feel there's quite a weight of expectation on me now. I'm not sure if my finds are going to live up to it. The first find I have is that in the UK, you need a TV license to watch any live TV. Obviously, this covers a premises, not a person. So obviously, this creates weird things if you've got people going around streaming media on their phone. So the rule is any device that runs on batteries and isn't connected to an external aerial, it's counted as being within the TV license of your home address rather than the address it's played in. This means that you can play live TV on your smartphone as long as you don't plug it in to charge. If you try and play TV on your smartphone while it's plugged in charging, you need a TV license for the location you're in. And this is £10 a month for those outside the UK. If you have it, as long as you have it unplugged while you're playing it, it's fine. You can go wherever you want. And this is just, to me, this just highlights the madness of the TV licensing system. That is just sorely out of date. Another interesting thing this may affect, and if you're considering doing it, obviously you should check it yourself, I could be wildly wrong, but if you're a student that lives at home with a TV license outside of term time, but in halls or wherever else during term time, you don't need a separate TV license as long as you play it on your laptop running on batteries, you know, stream or iPad or whatever.
Wow.
It is crazy. I used to actually be quite a supporter of the BBC and paying a TV license. I 10 years ago, I used to think the quality of its news was very good and almost worth paying for in itself. But maybe it's just me, but I found the quality of BBC News is, I never use it. And I never watch live television. In fact, the satellite dish here is broken. And I really, in an age of Netflix and on-demand TV, it's terrible. I find myself questioning it. At the same time, you know, in France, you pay a TV license and it doesn't go to, you know, a broadcasting corporation. So it's just a tax. So I suppose we do get something out of it. But I think this is going to happen soon rather than later, Ben. I think there's probably the Conservatives want to get rid of the BBC anyway. And they'll use some pseudo privatizing, let it compete with Netflix and Amazon to make it happen.
Yeah, I think it's going to be one way or the other. I think they're either going to change the TV license to cover all video, in which case there's just no option but to have one. Otherwise, you can't watch the animated video adverts they put on every single website.
Yeah.
Or it's going to be abolished. I think it's quite good value, and BBC does do a lot of really cool programming. It's the fact that you're forced to do it regardless of whether or not you want to watch the BBC.
Yeah.
You know, I remember the British public, I own Channel 4. Why the hell do I have to pay some other quasi-government agency to be allowed to watch it?
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah, they do some good stuff, but in percentage of the programming it creates, I don't think it's very representative of the stuff that I am interested in.
Yeah, it does seem to target a particular demographic of which I'm not.
Yeah.
A large part of that demographic is foreigners who buy license BBC content and therefore contribute to keeping our hospitals and schools going.
I did watch Wolf Hall. I thought that was a very good interpretation of Hilary Mantel's books, but also sold for a huge profit to international markets, so I didn't really need to pay for it.
Well, everybody wins.
We could turn this whole show into a rant for and against the BBC, and then we'll take on the trains.
It's also a good example of an industry where you can stimulate domestic growth through a Keynesian spending boost, because a lot of film and TV industries, they buy their stuff from companies within the UK. Like if you're filming in the UK, then your locations, your costume people, your actors, your extras, you know, lighting companies, catering companies, a lot of that money will be circulated back into the local economy.
And I think that's a good thing.
Well, of course it is.
I just wish, yeah, we had more choice.
The BBC is such a huge part of the creative spending in film and TV in the UK that I just feel that it just swamps it. You know, if you're not writing for the BBC or in the style to which the BBC wants, you're just pushed out of the industry.
Yeah, true.
You know, you don't have the sort of different ideas, the different styles and organisations there.
Yeah.
But I have more discoveries.
Oh.
Yes, more. If you have an Android phone and you go to Google, the website, and type in "find my phone," it will find your phone. It will send its tentacles out through the ether and locate your phone and display it on a Google map.
This is amazing. When you told me this last week, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, it freaks me out a bit. It is. It's very close to the creepy line. It may be beyond the creepy line.
It even found one of my phones without a SIM in it.
Hang on.
Found your phone without a SIM in it?
Yeah.
That's weird. But that's not going to find your phone if it's at home and you just, if it, you, it's below the sofa rather than
the battery's flat,
the coffee table. But another thing you can do is you can set it to ring at full volume, even if it's on silent, which is quite useful.
Yeah.
But yeah, if your battery's flat, then it won't help. But obviously, but why are you letting your battery go flat? Obviously, that damages the battery. Practicing good battery hygiene, alternate to 20% and 80%. And my final find of the fortnight is last fortnight I talked about setting up this Bluetooth stereo in an old, I think it's a 1947 radio that's no longer worked. And I bought some bits off AliExpress. And last night actually I finally got it all working, got it all plugged in. The first version, it was a horrendous hum and buzz and clicking in it. And when you connected your phone to the Bluetooth receiver in it, you got this sound like on old modems. When you connected to the internet. But anyway, I've managed to solve that now. And it's what's really surprising, I'm using the original speaker in there, I haven't put a new one in. And the sound quality in it is really good. I mean, as I say, I bought this amp for like £3 and I know nothing about audio. So I could be, I don't know, massively wrong. But it sounds better than almost any speaker I've ever had, which admittedly none of them have been that good. But a lot of them have been all right, sort of mid-range speakers. And I can only assume it's because back in 1947, when they made speakers, they made them properly. They made them to last 70 years and still sound good.
I don't think there's been any huge kind of shift in technology in speaker design as either, you know, and a lot of those, it's remarkable really when you look like a bass speaker for a Sonoros system, it's like £700 or something. And, you know, you can buy something like that and get a decent sound out of it.
I know nothing about audio, so anyone who did will probably listen to it and go, oh, all this thing all sounds wrong. But to me, it sounds really good.
It doesn't, well, that's all that's important.
Yeah.
Sounds really good.
It looks really good as well. And it made me feel really, I don't know what the word is, successful, cool, manly, something like that. I'd taken an old broken stereo and turned it into a modern Bluetooth speaker. And it's now our main sound system in the kitchen, so I can listen to it while I'm cooking my scrambled eggs in the morning.
You've inspired me to do something similar, because I've got like an old Panasonic boombox. That I've never thrown away because it sounded pretty good, but I never use it either because it's just got like a CD player in it. I might just kind of put something like that in the inside, and so I can just stream music to it. You keep it on batteries, you know, so I can put it wherever we go, and then
I've considered getting a boombox to do a big Bluetooth speaker thing.
Yeah,
is it the proper 80s style?
Yeah,
carry it on your shoulder, walking through.
It's not quite a 3D superwoofer, but something like that. That's what I had in the 80s.
Yeah. I mean, the setup of it was incredibly simple. I was really surprised that it all worked, to be honest. It seemed a bit too straightforward.
What was what caused the modem kind of distortion interference?
Well, the way I had it, there's no volume on the amp unit. So the way I had it set up originally is I just plugged in the Bluetooth receiver into the amp and then into the speaker and controlled the volume on my phone.
Yeah.
But the amp was basically too powerful for the speaker, so you always had to keep it turned down quite low. So that just meant that whatever noise there was in quite a high proportion to the signal.
Yeah.
So what I did was basically put a volume control set, just a few resistors.
Yeah, like an impedance mismatch.
Yeah, so I added some resistors before the speaker, and then you could turn the volume right up, and then it just, that's just drowned out the noise completely. So even when it's on silent because of the volume going down, it's all right.
That's brilliant. Sounds like a great project. I'm going to do something similar, I think, when I get a chance. So they are our finds and discoveries. Thanks.
Which brings us hurtling towards a halfway reminder. Still to come. Still to come, there's the 1 minute hate and a voice of the masses.
Yeah, did you want to say anything else, Andrew?
No, just going to ask who is going to be today's Emmanuel Goldstein? Who's hating now?
Yeah, we didn't have any neurons or og boxes this episode. But I know that Ben is seething with hatred about something, so we thought we would bring back our good old 1 minute rant section, because it's nice and fast and gets us moving through the podcast. So Ben, I'm going to start a timer. Okay, what are you going to hate on this episode?
It's a toss-up. It could be David Cameron, could be Theresa May.
Did we used to have a wheel to do this? Is this what we used to do? Was that
how that was something else, wasn't that, it?
It would be good to have a wheel of hate, though.
Yeah, we should get a wheel of hate. Hold on, I can put a wheel of hate together. Let me do that right now. Hold on. Okay, I've got a wheel of hate.
Okay.
Shall I spin the dial on this wheel of hate?
Okay, hang on. How's this going to work? You spin the wheel, you read it out, and then I have a minute to hate on whatever the wheel of hate lands on.
Yeah, yeah.
So are you ready with a stopwatch, Mike?
I am. I can start a timer any moment.
Okay, so I'll spin the wheel of hate. What is it going to say, Ben? something about HTML high DPI rendering, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's up there. So I'll put that alongside System D and Pulse Audio, Grub, Arch Wiki is on there as well. let's see what happens if I spin this thing that I've just made. Okay, here we go. Oh, and it's stopped on your chosen subject.
So I've got a minute on image rendering in high DPI HTML.
Let me count you down and then I'll set you off. 3, 2, 1, go.
This might sound like a slightly obscure topic, but it's one that really, really annoys me, possibly irrationally so. The way it works, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, images basically have a resolution. You have a number of dots. These dots are displayed on the pixels on your screen. That is an image. But along came high DPI manufacturers, particularly Apple, and they thought, oh, no, let's not do that. Let's take the number of dots, scale it to twice the size, and then display it. Now, viewers looking at this through their high DPI screen go, oh, that image looks fuzzy. Of course it looks fuzzy. Your browser's decided to display it at twice the resolution it's creating it. It's always going to look fuzzy. So then they complain to the web designer and say, oh, your image looks fuzzy. No, your stupid browser is displaying it at twice the size of the image. Of course it's going to look fuzzy. Don't blame me. File a bug report with your browser manufacturer and tell them to sort it the hell out. But no, apparently we now have to create new special ways of dealing with this in our CSS and HTML and rendering, and it all comes down to us poor fools who have to build the websites.
There we go.
Does that mean that those high resolution images get sent to every browser regardless of whether they display them or not?
Not necessarily. You can, the sort of correct way is to put some jazz either as a JavaScript to decide which image to pull, or in the
browser
server side to decide which to send based on user agent.
Okay.
But if you're lazy, you just send it to everyone. In fact, that's what we've had to do on the form that I've recently created. We had no option of injecting the JavaScript or the server side code, so we've just had to send, you know, four times too much data to almost everyone, so a few people can get the right image.
I feel sorry for those poor people sitting in Munich Airport with no decent internet connection who are downloading needlessly large images.
Oh, does that browser that you found, Mike, translate images into ASCII art? That would be cool.
You can do that with something from Libkaka. That's
amazing.
An external tool. But it will display images. You have to really ramp up the terminal size and knock the font down to make something remotely usable. But it is possible.
Isn't there a tool to display YouTube videos as ASCII?
Yeah.
I think you can render pretty much anything. Again, it's using this Libkaka. It's like, I think it goes through SDL, so you can render anything that runs on SDL, which is a huge amount of software, down to the terminal. Although I think the rate of screen updates there would be so fast, even at Munich Airport, it would be a bit of a push.
But at least you can copy and paste it.
True. Anyway, thanks for that rant, Ben. I think we could probably bring this section back.
Yeah, I'll make maybe a few more modifications to this Wheel of Destiny, so you know it's not so hackneyed next time. And maybe I can find the old one. Did we bring it back from the old office? Was it even ours? I don't know. These questions and
is it copyrighted?
Oh, after that rage and awfulness, it's time for some happy feelings now. So, voice of the masses, the question is, who is your Linux or free software hero? And it's great. It made me so happy reading it this morning, because most people have picked somebody different. It's not as if there's one guiding light of awesomeness that we all must follow. Everybody's got a different reason for holding this individual up and saying, yeah, these people are great. So let's get on with it. Who is your open source free software hero? Neil McPhail says, I have two nominations. Fabrice Bellard is a genius. As well as developing QEMU and FFmpeg, he's carried out ridiculous hacks with video cards, JavaScript and mathematics. Just read his Wikipedia page, I can't do him justice. And Simon Tatham is responsible for keeping me sane. PuTTY allows me to use Linux on my Windows work desktop. His puzzles collection is awesome. He also developed NASM, which allows me to relive my youthful enthusiasm for assembly and machine code.
Hey, I didn't know that. I use NASM loads. Oh, mad props.
Jack says, it's totally Simon Phipps, eloquent, engaged, and pushing hard for open licenses. Sinead says, Liam at Gaming on Linux. Works so hard to bring the gaming Linux news for thousands to read. Hello, Liam, in disguise. Dale, but another gaming type person is Dale McGee's nomination, which is Ryan C. Gordon, aka Iculus. Most of his work has been on porting proprietary games, but he's done open source stuff too, such as work on SDL and designing Fat Elf. And he supports the community with his website, with his talks. Ryan has probably done more for gaming on Linux than any other individual. Great stuff. Another shout out for Ryan C. Gordon and Edward Rudd, who is the porting technical director at Humble. Yeah, but of course, really, what we've just been aiming for, we were just fishing, really. Down to Rakios, who says, I'd like to nominate the Linux Voice team. Go on, give yourselves a pat on the back.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's quite...
There we go. So before we go back to the people of Linux Voice, how about you, people of Linux Voice? You, Ben, do you have a particular open source hero?
I'm going to be a little bit boring, I think, and say one of the obvious ones. For me, it's Linus.
He's not that obvious because nobody else has picked his name out.
Yeah, that's surprising, isn't it?
Because lots of people have created operating systems that work, that are open source, but it's his stewardship that has seen it go from a little hobbyist operating system to being probably the most widely used operating system in the world. Overtaking every proprietary operating system when you add up all the different Android phones, etc., etc. And it's so when he knows he's right, he sticks to it and he pushes it through, and that's worked out, and it's led to a fantastic OS.
Yeah, I would say Linus as well. I mean, there are loads of people like Stallman who are absolutely supremely helpful and useful for the whole movement. But the thing that strikes me is an email exchange I saw a few years ago where some people were trying to get a debugger put into the Linux kernel so that they could reboot if something crashes, then fix it. And Linus Torvalds said, no, I'm not putting it in there. Just write good code in the first place. And I just like that. There's so much stuff they could have thrown in the kernel, a million different bits and bobs, but Torvalds has been he's kept a very good line, pragmatic line, saying this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to make it work. I admire that sort of that management, I say management skill. He kind of go off on big rants with people, but that's what I like about him.
Speaking of dictatorships, Tom says, I may be unpopular because of this, but I think Mark Shuttleworth has done a great job with Canonical and Ubuntu. as it has helped Linux spread out and become more widely available and known about. I highly doubt manufacturers such as Dell, HP, etc. would be selling PCs with Linux on them if it wasn't for Ubuntu. Ubuntu has become the go-to distribution for anyone who is interested in trying Linux, and I think we should thank Shuttleworth for that. Les W completely agrees, and for the same reasons. I completely agree, and I would also have to add Gail Duval's name into that for the same reason. Making Linux accessible, pretty is a feature.
That's a good point. Reiki. Yeah, we don't often talk about Gail Duval anymore, the creator of Mandrake. But I think he's still doing open source stuff. I think they sold the Ultio, didn't they? We've talked about it before, so I don't know what he's doing these days.
Yeah, this is so Mandrake Linux, which was run by Gail Duval, was really one of the first to introduce a nice graphical installer.
Yeah.
A non-expert could use. Rekios says, I'd like to nominate the Linux voice team. Go on, give yourselves a pat on the back.
Again.
Ray Woods, the role of honour is just too big to pick out one or two individuals, especially if you go back to the roots BL before Linux. Like all technology, we stand on the shoulders of giants, so let's have a big hand for whomever first picked up two rocks and banged them together. Lucifer did say Linus Torvalds for the most awesome piece of software ever, Git, and Bill and Bill Joy for creating the only true text editor.
No, V or VI or
V or six.
Six.
Without any further explanation, Rocket Dog says William Henry Gates III. Bean Counter again, Fabrice Bellard. He must be, I've never heard of him, but Bean Counter says that the guy is just a rock star. I think about FFmpeg, QMU, and my favourite, TCC. He has some really cool creations to his name. The great thing is that even with all of this creativity, there is no mention of bad language.
Isn't Fabrice Bellard also the guy behind JS Linux? That there's a website you can go to and it boots up a Linux kernel in a JavaScript PC.
Oh yeah, I've seen that. That's really cool.
I'm pretty sure that's the same guy. He's one of those sort of low profile hackers who just gets stuff done and yet does incredibly amazing work.
So we did say free and open source software, which is quite a wide remit. Jake says Tim Berners-Lee because he did it for science. Yeah, damn right. Where would free software be without the web?
Yeah, and he's also a great proponent of the free web, you know, of keeping it free and of keeping DRM out of it, which is very free software.
Graham, who's your free software hero?
It's been really...
Do you even have one?
It's a difficult question. I know everyone else has just given one. It's so difficult to give just one. Gail Duval is a good example. Matthias Ettrick, who created KDE, obviously is a personal hero. I've got a bit of a crush on Cory Doctorow. I think the older I get, the more principled people and the people who stand by their principles I find hugely inspirational. And he's the way that he releases his work for free and also his involvement with the EFF. Similarly, Larry Lessig for his work on the EFF and the Creative Commons. And also, you know, Karen Sandler and Stormy Peters, both with their work in the GNOME Foundation and what Karen Sandler does to raise awareness for software running and small bits of medical kit. And people like Eben Moglen, who don't often get a shout out because he's a lawyer, but all of the work that he did pro bono to enable us to have, you know, the legal framework that is the GPL2 and GPL v3. These things, you know, just fundamental. Sorry, that's like 10.
Oh, I want to change my answer just for the trolling effect. It's Leonard Pickering.
I don't think I could choose just one.
Graham, when you said Eben Moglen just then, I had a little mental picture of Eben Upton sitting next to the speaker, leaning forward, hearing his first name and then feeling crushed and heartbroken in disappointment. So just for him, Bean Counter says, the second person for me is Eben Upton. Yes, I know he is more in Raspberry Pi and hardware, but the impact that Raspberry Pi is having on free software makes him the second big hero. Brian, I've got to say, Bruce Perens for a long list of contributions. Busybox, Debian Social Contract, Open Source Definition, and the OSI.
Where to start,
Yep.
Jeremy Allison and Samba. Where would we be without Samba?
Ah, dear. Zero small x capital FFC says, is that even a question? Space question mark. Of course it is. You can tell by how many people have answered it. RMS.
It wasn't a RMS question until we had the first answer.
RMS. Torvalds is pretty ordinary hacker. There will be other person if Torvalds didn't exist, but I am not sure about RMS. My mind blown away by ignorance of these comments. Torvalds, Sarah Sharp, really? Do you have any political understanding? RMS's impact was huge, not only in the computer science world, in the whole politics world. Every one of us owes RMS more than anybody in today's what's called free operating system.
Welcome. Welcome to Linux Voice.
Welcome to Linux Voice. That's very disappointing. Roche Limit says, rather more reasonably than unpronounceable name, most of the comic book heroes I liked were anti-heroes, flawed characters, but with an overwhelming sense of justice and injustice, like Marvel's Wolverine, who, despite the huge body count, seemed rather likeable in the end. So who would be the floss anti-hero? It has to be RMS. Thrashing around, tearing into all and sundry proprietary supervillains in his zeal to rid the world of things that offend him. Like all anti-heroes, it takes some effort to like him, but it is undeniable that he has had a massive impact for good. That's how you do it, OXFFC. Oh dear. Right then. One more. Two more. Three more. Brilliant. Stephen Wheeler, I'd like to nominate Alan Cox. He was instrumental in making Linux usable in the early days when he installed Linux on a Computer Society machine at the University of Swansea and set about fixing many bugs and becoming one of the main kernel maintainers. As a strong free software advocate, he went on to work for Red Hat and Intel and has been involved in many free software projects like GNOME and Xorg. Wow. Above and beyond all this, he's a model railway enthusiast running his own company producing N-Gage kits. He has one of the all-time great beards and he's Welsh. Always a good thing.
I think, from my memory, Alan Cox is English, but he'd moved to Swansea and learnt Welsh.
Yeah, is that how it works? I thought Welshness was passed on through the mother's line in the mitochondrial DNA. David Greengas, I vote for Martin Gracelin. He's not only a great developer, he's always positive amid some not-so-nice feedback. Wow. There was a recent post about a prominent developer stating that KDE Plasma 5 is not usable. Instead of ignoring it or getting enraged about it, he has been logically addressing it through a variety of blog posts. If we had more developers like Martin, we would have more great applications and less vitriol. Speaking of vitriol, Kevin O'Brien says, I will nominate Sarah Sharp for doing the right thing and calling out bad behaviour. I know some people think men behaving badly is always excusable and women should just stop talking about it, but that's wrong. There is a sexism problem in open source and it needs to be addressed. We cannot thrive by driving away half of our talent. Seconded by Luke Jones and Jan. Hey, there we go. Oh, no, sorry, one more. Paddy from Linux Luddites. We'd like to second the previous nominations for Fabrice Ballard and Theo Durat, and would like to add an older name into the mix, Doug McElroy, who invented pipes. Wow. And facilitated a modular architecture that resulted in the growth of tools that do one thing and do it well. Ah, the Unix fella, I remember him. Yeah, he was mentioned in one of Juliet's excellent tutorials about the history of languages and programming and open source. So, in summary, lots of really cool people have helped make free software.
This has been one of my favourite Voices of the Masses ever. It just feels so good. And I'm amazed at the diversity of the names that we've got as well. It's brilliant. And it's great to be able to give even just a brief thought to those people, all the people who have been listed. Really good.
Yeah. Well, Fabrice Ballard is clearly the winner and the best. So I'm just going to go on Wikipedia him now.
Do we need to send him like a little penguin Oscar or something? Penguin Oscar.
We could give him a free subscription.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Free digital subscription, Fabrice Bellard.
Yep. I've also got to say that I'm deeply in love with Karen for being just so great.
Sorry, yeah, we didn't actually ask you, did we? That's the problem when you're hosting a section.
Karen Sandler, she's just fantastic. It's so, so easy to talk about software freedom and open source code as an abstract concept, which we know to be, we sort of take it as an article of faith that it's a good thing, and we sort of think that other people should appreciate it and realise why. But she's so mega, mega smart. She's clearly like in the twits, you know, when you see the good person there, it shines out from them. Like you can see her brain just radiating out from her. And she's really, really good.
Yeah, and they do such a good job for not very much money, really, in a very difficult environment. And yet they're supremely qualified, and they do it because they love it and they want to make a difference. And it's, yeah, fantastic.
And that's all the weather. If you'd like to go back and read those comments, I recommend you do so. It's at linuxvoice.com in the Voice of the Masses section. And you know, please add your own contribution, because you know it's just wonderful to see such love and positivity. Apart from that one fool at the end who ruined everything.
Oh, let's forget about him. Let's erase him from our collective memories.
Yeah. Let's ban him.
Let's rewrite history.
Yeah.
We just need a DeLorean.
So that's it. That's the end of episode 18.
Wow.
Let's go. It's been a long one.
Has a mighty podcast.
Super busy.
Beast.
Yes. Thanks everyone for listening. It's been great. Hopefully we'll speak to you all in 2 weeks' time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.